Hello, podcast listeners. We wanted to let you know that we have a very cool opportunity for you. Peter Max is bringing his psychedelic counterculture pop art to Austin's Russell Collection, and we will be giving away signed posters of his work to celebrate. So anyone who emails the promo code MEETPETERMAX to podcasts@KUT.org before August 16th, 2016, will be entered into a drawing to receive one of these coveted posters. We'll be drawing 10 names on August 20th, and we'll contact the winners on August 25th. Again, that's promo code MEETPETERMAX. Just email us at podcasts@KUT.org with that in the subject line, and you are entered to win. Good luck, and thanks for listening.
A lot of people tell us that we missed something in a show, or a lot of people tell us they were, you know, grateful that we mentioned something in a show, and sometimes we respond to their emails directly. But since our elves don't work over the weekends or at nights, oddly enough, we don't respond to everybody. And so we wanted to have an opportunity where people could go to the podcast and we could respond in a big way, and sometimes also just directly to comments from our listeners, because we appreciate them.
We did a show a couple weeks ago, and at the very end of the show, I made a comment that was a bit of an overgeneralization, in which I basically said that what hearing aids are doing is jacking up the volume across the board. And if you had access to all the tape that we have access to, you'd know that in the much longer conversation that we had surrounding this show, we actually talked about the fact that a lot of hearing aids are much more sophisticated than just jacking up the volume across the board. But several listeners rightly pointed out that's not exactly what modern hearing aids are doing. In the past, there were plenty of hearing aids that were just doing that. And now they are more sophisticated in that they will influence the volume more selectively. And there are several ways to do that. One is to focus on those areas of the auditory spectrum that are related to language. And others actually try to map the damage on the cochlea and then essentially amplify those areas of the auditory spectrum that are the ones that are most damaged in that particular individual's cochlea.
Right. I mean, it's probably worth talking a little bit about the fact, we don't need to get a lot of this because we're talking about the psychology of hearing loss and not the technicalities of hearing loss, but it's probably important to understand that even though when we listen to someone speak and we recognize their voice as their voice, we sort of hear it as one thing, when actually their voice is made of lots of frequencies of vibration to which our ear responds to in different ways. And when hearing loss occurs, it means that some frequencies are no longer perceived as easily as some other frequencies, which makes it difficult to hear. And through the wonders of evolution, it just so happens that we are most sensitive to that band of frequencies where human voices live. And of course, when you have damage to your hearing system, whether it has to do with an inner ear problem and what Art was just referring to as the cochlea, which is what changes the mechanical vibrations of sound into electrochemical signals that can be perceived by the brain, then it's possible to selectively deal, as Art was just saying, with parts of the cochlea that are necessary to do that. But of course, when you have the capacity to use computers and very small computers to deal with sound processing, is with something the size that'll fit into somebody's ear canal or a little device that hangs behind the back of their ear, that's a very attractive thing. But one of the things that we mentioned on the show was that those are very expensive, and most healthcare that involves Medicare, Medicaid, those kinds of things, which many older people who are the most likely to experience hearing loss don't have access to that level of device. But as we were just talking about a minute ago, there's some recent research that suggests that there are some very relatively inexpensive devices. I say relatively inexpensive, between $300 and $400, which for many people is still pretty expensive, but certainly not at the level of $3,000 to $5,000, which some devices cost, that can actually do a pretty good job of more than just making everything louder, as Art was saying before.
Yeah. And you did, I mean, you mentioned that when we were taping. I left it out.
Yeah, well, you can't.
But we got, had this, I mean, that was one thing that one of the listeners wrote about was like, you know, I don't have access to these hearing aids because I can't afford it and it's not covered by health insurance. And I think it's something that, even though we don't talk about it a lot, you know, access to care is a huge problem.
And if we also think about what devices can and can't do for us, and let's get, because this gets back to the psychology of it rather than the technical aspects of some of the devices. One of the things that we tend to think about our sensory systems is that the outer part of our sensory system, whether it's the retina of the eye or the cochlea in the ear, are largely just transducing some signal from the world into something the brain can understand. Sort of like if you had an if you're recording on a computer, you have this analog to digital converter, and what's happening at the front end is just taking the signal and turning it into something the computer can understand, and then everything interesting after that happens in the computer. And so you might think, well, okay, so what's happening at the eye or the ear is we're just doing that transduction, and then everything else interesting is happening in the brain. Well, that's not completely true. It turns out that elements of attention actually start from the beginning. So in your eyes, you know, we've talked about with vision how you have this one very small area of clear vision called the fovea that's about the size of your thumbnail if you're holding your arm at arm's length, which means that from the beginning you are choosing what to pay attention to by where you point your eyes. And similarly, there are attentional processes going on at the cochlea. And when you sustain damage to the cochlea, you are not only damaging your ability to transduce the signals, you're also damaging some of your ability to do auditory attention. And right now, the devices, as sophisticated as they are, and as much as they try to tailor the amplification to the ear of the individual who has that damage, they still aren't affecting the damage to the attentional capacities that are happening as a result of the problems of the cochlea.
That's great.
Which is one of the reasons why it's just so hard to overcome hearing loss. And we got another note from a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of Texas.
Is this still on hearing? No,
this is still hearing. Yay.
Oh yeah, okay.
So we got another note on the topic of hearing from a distinguished professor, Dennis McFadden, who studies hearing, and one of the things that he pointed out was he said, look, love what you did on the show, but you didn't really make clear how important hearing is to people's lives. And he's absolutely right. You know, most of us think, well, vision, man, that's the most important thing. If I couldn't see the world, then I'd really be totally lost. But hearing actually influences a tremendous amount of our ability to interact in the world, partly because most of our language happens through auditory means. And so obviously there are sign languages that are very powerful, but in order to speak in a sign language with someone, you have to be in visual contact with them and pretty darn good visual contact with them. Whereas, you know, somebody can call you from the other room or over the telephone and have a conversation with you. And in addition, your whole sense of space is influenced by your ability to hear, which is why it's so dangerous, for example, to be bicycling with earbuds in, because now you don't have that sense of the world around you. And your vision now gets locked into just the task of navigating. And your ears now alert you to all sorts of other things that are going on around you. So hearing is extraordinarily important. And so he one of the reasons he wrote this was because he said, you know, we need to really hammer home how important it is for people to protect their hearing, because as Bob pointed out in the original show, it's really easy to sustain damage mm-hmm. to your to hearing, and once it's gone, it's gone, and life gets more and more difficult the less you can hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so. It's so weird because you don't feel it going away. I think, right. Which is what you pointed out, right. too. It's right. not something like, yeah. you know, a bang to the head necessarily.
Yeah.
Where you're like, there goes a brain cell or yeah. 1,200.
Well, and that's the insidious thing about hearing loss and any kind of damage that is gradually progressive. Because if you think about what happens, you go to a loud music concert and you leave and your ears are ringing for a while, but the ringing stops. But after repeated exposures like that, you don't recognize that after the ringing has stopped, you don't actually hear as well as you did before you spent all those days or evenings or whatever in a really loud club. Yeah, that's something that I tried to get some people interested in and failed miserably about 10 years ago about making a campus effort to have a hearing protection thing. You know, I mean, it started because I used to, you know, the Longhorn Band Rehearsal Hall is down the hall from my office, you know, and I would go in there sometimes and see the drum line in there, you know, beating their brains out with no hearing protection whatsoever. And I would just go in there and lose it. I would just lose my shit just to scare them, you know, and said, I don't want to see another person playing an instrument in this room without hearing protection. You know, don't let me come back in here and do that. And after a while, fortunately, the Longhorn Band now provides hearing protection for the whole band. I mean, not just the... I mean, if you think you have a band of, 350 people all blowing instruments pretty loud, even when you're outside, it's really loud. And ears just weren't meant to be in sustained volume at that level, right? I mean, it's not just the... our ears are pretty good at responding to a fast... loud sound, right? Because what happens is the muscles that control the bones in our ear tense up, and so it kind of keeps them from sending damaging vibrations to the cochlea. But over a sustained period of time, it just doesn't work.
Yeah. You know, what's tinnitus?
It's, I mean...
Fear of what's going to happen this evening.
That is... Did you just do that just now? Oh, my God. The man is a miracle. He's a miracle.
See, this is what we have to put up with.
This is what we have to put up with. Oh, my God. This is what doesn't make it into the show. Because people would just be, like, sitting there in their car going, oh, my, what? Did he just really say that? He said that.
He did say that.
He said that.
Yeah.
My exactly. kids are listening to this going, Dad.
Oh, God. Oh.
Now everyone's going to know.
I can't concentrate for the rest of the day. That's it. I'm done. Oh, should we answer your question?
It's
literally a sustained sense of ringing in your ears. I mean, a sustained very high pitch. It varies in intensity and consistency among sufferers of tinnitus. It is not a real sound. Obviously, you're not really responding to a sound in the environment, but your nerve cells that are associated with certain frequencies are firing, so your brain actually thinks there's sound in the environment when it's not. Many people who have mild cases of tinnitus just learn to ignore the sounds. I mean, I have mild tinnitus, so there's always ringing in my ears. But it just, like most things that are constant, you habituate to it and you stop paying attention to it because brains know that nothing's changing, so stop paying attention to that, right? But for some people, it's quite pronounced and quite annoying and in some cases debilitating, right? And there are some therapies that people have used for this. I don't know how successful they are. Maybe
I haven't seen any good studies.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah.
No. So we got it. I think that's good. Anything else we wanted to respond? We wanted to respond
so
to...
So we could do something. Do we want to respond to the happiness?
Who is the... What is the happiness?
Rock.
Rock.
Yeah. And this is just... We're responding to listeners' comments and questions and, stuff that we missed in shows that I cut out because of the stuff. Sorry, guys.
We want to say this is Two Guys in Your Head.
Listeners.
Listener response.
Talk back.
So talk back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So mail. It's mail time.
Mail time.
And while we need to do a shout out to Amy Cuddy, who always is promoting us and
yes,
stuff.
Thank you. Thanks, Amy.
So anyway, keep going.
Happiness? happiness?
Happiness.
Or do we want to do an actual show now?
No, wait, let's do the happiness.
Let's respond to happiness.
So, let's do the rock.
The rock. So we got a listener email about our show on happiness, hope, and motivation, saying that perhaps the word dissatisfaction that we used in the show was ill-advised, because really, a fulfilling life is one in which people spend a tremendous amount of time feeling satisfied and happy with their lives. Do we really want to tell people that in order to get stuff done, you have to be dissatisfied? And I think what we want to say about that is, you know, we're all for happiness.
But the show wasn't about happiness at all.
No, it was
about hope.
It was
motivation.
About hope. That's right.
Like, what role does hope play in
that's
motivating?
That's right.
Us?
In motivation. And I think that the listener was responding, in reasonably so, to the word dissatisfaction. That because dissatisfaction is a negative word, right? When you're dissatisfied with something, then you're not at your peak of happiness. There's something missing. And in the extremes, dissatisfaction is not just a diminishment of your happiness. It can actually make you angry, upset, and frustrated.
It's not a bad thing to be dissatisfied.
No, that's the thing.
I think therein is the confusion here, is that I think it's conflating the idea of happiness with satisfaction and unhappiness with dissatisfaction. If we think about it from a strictly psychological point of view, my motivation to get up and fill my glass of water because I'm thirsty is motivated by my dissatisfaction with the sense of thirst, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so I'm now going to make myself satisfied because more. I'm
Doesn't
not unhappy.
Doesn't throw you into a tizzy.
Yeah. I'm not unhappy because I know I can solve my dissatisfaction by getting a drink of water.
Now, if you fill that glass with vodka...
Even better.
But maybe you were a little unhappy before that.
But there is something that I think what you said, though, about the fact that you know you can fill your glass of water.
Exactly.
And then you're not.
Right.
Then you're not unhappy.
Right.
Because it's your ability to fill a glass of water and have something to drink.
Right.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, unhappiness is much more closely associated with a feeling of lack of control than a feeling of dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's the fact that you're dissatisfied and you don't think there's anything you can do about it, which leads to unhappiness. And that was not what we were talking about when we were talking about being dissatisfied as motivating.
In fact, those situations in which there's something that you don't have that you can't get because you're blocked from it are often demotivating.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there's nothing you can do, there's nothing you can do.
Right.
And motivation is all about action. Motivation is all about doing stuff. No, that's right. And as Bob says, it is all about the perception of your ability to do something or not. And I mean, a lot of times when we're intervening with people to try to help them to overcome a problem, part of what we're doing is to help them to recognize that something that they thought was insurmountable is actually something that they can do something about.
Yeah, exactly.
And one of the reasons why a lot of these mindset interventions are so valuable from the work of Carol Dweck and her colleagues is because what these mindsets do is to shift your belief from I can't do this, that's a signal that I'm incapable of this constitutionally, to I can't do this, which means I need to work harder to gain skills in order to be able to do this. And that growth mindset is motivating precisely because it gives people the sense that there's a challenge that can be overcome.
Yeah, so maybe the modification we can make is that dissatisfaction plus the sense that you can do something about resolving the dissatisfaction.
Which we could call self-efficacy.
We could call it that. I think someone may have in the past.
That's right.
Is that combination is what leads to the motivation, right? If you're dissatisfied, as Archie, I'm summarizing now, if you're dissatisfied and you think, what are you going to do? That's not motivating.
Yeah.
Right? So it's the motivation plus the belief that you have the capacity to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know what affects my happiness, though, is people using the word impact as a verb. When you say impacts my happiness, it makes me less happy.
Did I say that?
You did. Did you?
Oh, I suck at English.
It went right through.
English is not my first language. So I have difficulties.
I know.
No.
But I think, Art, you're not acknowledging the impactfulness of the notion that not... But being a not being a native speaker.
The thing is, though,
the next impact you're going to feel is this coffee mug.
Your dissatisfaction
curled at high velocity across the studio.
Your dissatisfaction with my use of the English language has impacted me to change.
You did it again.
So noted.